This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Escape Clause by John Sanford. Read for you by Eric Conger. 1. Peck popped a Xanax, screwed the cap back on the pill tube, peered over the top of the bush and through the chain-link fence, and in a hoarse whisper asked, "You see the other one?" The big man with the rifle whispered, "Right by that tree, above the first one. She's looking down at him. Get her." The big man rested the muzzle of the rifle in the V of one of the chain links, pulled the trigger. The rifle made a pop sound, not much louder than a hand clap. They waited, staring into the darkness. Then Peck said, "Ah, you dumb shit, you missed her. You missed her. She should be down, but she's not. She's moving. Might have hit that brush, deflected the shot. She's moving out in the open. Reload," Peck said. "I'm doing it. Get off my back, will you?" "Can you see her now?" Peck asked. "She's getting curious about why the guy's just lying there." Pop. "Got her. Saw it hit," the big man said. "Sure she's down? We don't want to make a mistake." "She's going down now," the big man whispered. "I'm pretty sure." Peck could smell the nicotine and tar on the other man's breath. The big guy was addicted to Octomar black flames and almost always had one stuck to his lower lip. But not now. Peck reached out and slapped him on the back of the head and said, "I don't want to hear that pretty sure. You know what happens if you're wrong? We're dead men. You fucking slap me again and I'll stick the gun butt up your ass and twist it sideways." A small man, crouched on the other side of the rifleman, said, "I saw them get hit. I saw it, man. Both of them. But who knows if it was enough?" They all went silent for a moment, squinting into the dark. Two bodies lay in the short grass, unmoving. The fence was 20 feet high and stouter than a normal chain link, a prison fence. With no sign of movement on the other side, Peck said, "Hamlet, cut the fence." "What if they're faking?" The small guy had half circles under his eyes, so dark they looked like broken blue poker chips. "You're the one who said they got hit," Peck said. The soapy touch of Xanax was slipping into his brain. The small guy said, "Maybe we ought to split. I'm not feeling so sure about this." "We're here. It's done. Cut the fucking fence," Peck said. Hamlet's side cutters made a grunt sound as he snipped each piece of wire. Grunt, grunt, grunt. They'd come well equipped. They wore rubber kitchen gloves and black clothing and trucker hats, and in addition to the gun, had brought a roll of black duct tape they'd used to put the fence back together when they left. Hamlet was cutting a wide oval in the fence, leaving it hinged on one side. He'd gotten halfway around the oval when the big man, Hake, hissed and touched his brother's arm and whispered, "Someone's coming." They sank into the brush, and Hake moved the muzzle of the rifle around until it pointed out at the perimeter road. 20 seconds later, a man in a gray uniform ambled along the road, looking at nothing in particular, talking to himself. When he was directly opposite them, 40 feet away, they heard him say, "I told him not to give her the money. She'll blow it on herself. That's what she'll do, and you know it. It won't get to your mom. She doesn't care about your mom." Peck realized that the security guard was wearing an earpiece and was talking into a cell phone. He lost the thread of what the man was saying as he disappeared around the curve of the frontage road. When the guard was well out of earshot, Hamlet whispered, "I think he had a gun." "No, he didn't. I checked that out," Peck said. "Not in the middle of the night." "The guards are not armed," Peck said. Hake said, "Ham, keep cutting. We're almost there." Hamlet went back to cutting, and 2 minutes later pulled open the cut curve of fencing like a gate. Peck said, "Go on. Crawl through there." "Why don't you crawl there?" Hamlet asked. Peck had no immediate answer for that, and the Xanax now had a good grip on him, so he said, "All right, I will. Hold the fence." Hamlet pulled the fence farther back. When Peck was through, he turned to Hake and said, "Give me the gun." Not loaded. That's okay, I'm going to use it as a poker. Hake handed him the gun, and Peck crawled 15 feet to the first body and poked it with the gun's muzzle. No reaction. That was a good thing. The other body was 10 feet farther on. He poked that one, too, got no response. He turned around and whispered, "We're good." "Told ya," Hamlet said too loud. Peck whispered, "Shut up, you fucking moron. Get the dollies in here." Hake pushed the dollies through the hole in the fence and rolled them over to the bodies. The dollies were the kind used by garden shops, with a flat bed and wide, soft wheels. "Goddamn heavier than hell," Hake said, as they lifted the first body onto a dolly. They couldn't see much farther than 15 or 20 feet away, and the moon didn't help. It sat right on the western horizon and splashed a silvery light off the trees around them. The contrast made it hard to discern shapes and movement. "Gonna have to push them through the fence one at a time, right out to the perimeter," Peck said. Despite the Xanax, he was sweating heavily. Not from the hot summer night, but from fear. He could smell the stink of it on himself. They loaded the second body on the second dolly and pushed them one at a time through the fence. Then Peck and Hake dragged the dollies through the brush to the edge of the perimeter road, while Hamlet pulled the fence back to its original configuration and taped some of the cut ends together with strips of the black duct tape. 5 quick repairs, and the fence looked like new. In the night, anyway. When Hamlet joined the others out at the perimeter road, Peck said, "I'm gonna scout. When you see the laser, bring them." They nodded, and he moved slowly along the edge of the perimeter road, where he could quickly step into the brush if he needed to. Peck had planned the whole operation, and he knew there were only a couple of night guards. From that point of view, having a guard pass by only minutes before was a good thing, if a little unnerving. That meant the other guard was a half mile away, and the one they'd seen probably wouldn't be back around for an hour or more. The perimeter road curved gently to Peck's right. When he had gotten to the exit point and had seen nobody, he stepped out to the road's edge, took a laser pointer from his chest pocket, aimed it back toward Hake and Hamlet, and played the red dot across their hiding place. A minute later, in the ambient light from the parking lot, he saw them move out onto the road, pulling the dollies with their motionless loads. They moved slowly at first, and then more urgently, and finally began to trot. The tires were almost, but not quite, silent. There was no one but Peck to hear them. When Hake and Hamlet came up, Peck led them across the road to another chain-link fence, which they'd already cut. They rolled the dollies through the fence, down a mild slope to the edge of a grassy yard with a darkened house 80 feet away. They waited there while Hamlet repaired the second fence, this time with silver duct tape. A scummy pond lay off to their left, home to any number of green and black frogs. Earlier in the summer, when they were making scouting trips, the frogs had been croaking their froggy asses off. Now that Peck could use the covering noise, they were resolutely silent. Hamlet finished with the fence, and they eased the dollies across the yard to the back door of the garage, pushed the door open, pulled the dollies inside, and closed the door. Hake took a flashlight out of a cargo pocket and turned it on. The van was ready, cargo doors open. They rolled the dollies up a wheelchair ramp into the back of the van, closed the doors. Hamlet and Hake got into the van, Hake as the wheelman, while Peck went to the door into the house, stepped inside, and looked out a kitchen window at the street. He was looking out at a suburban neighborhood, a bunch of 3-bedroom houses where everybody worked day jobs and the kids went to school. The houses were almost all dark, and the street was empty. He hurried back to the garage, pulling the house door closed behind himself, and pushed the wall switch for the garage door opener. The garage door went up, but no light came on, because Peck had thought of everything. They'd loosened the garage light. Hake drove the van out of the garage. Peck pushed the wall switch again, and the door started down. There was an ankle-high infrared safety light that beamed across the door opening to keep the door from closing on children who might be standing beneath it. Peck stepped carefully over it. He really had groomed the plan, he thought, with nothing left to chance. Went to the van and climbed into the back seat. Hake rolled it down to the street, took a right, and Hamlet said,
"Made it."
2. The cloudless sky was blue, of course, but the pale blue that tended almost to green. If you were lying naked in a Minnesota swimming hole on a hot summer day, looking up through the branches of the creekside cottonwoods, thinking about nothing much except the prospect of lunch. Virgil Flowers was doing that, bathed in the cool spring water and the scent of fresh-mown hay. Frankie Nobles's oldest son was windrowing the tethered hay, riding a 70s International Harvester tractor, the all-original diesel engine clattering up and down the 80-acre field on the other side of the crooked line of cottonwoods. Virgil usually managed to evade the whole haying process, pleading the exigencies of law enforcement, but with this last cut of the summer, Frankie had her eye on him. All her farm equipment was marginal, and though a neighbor would be over with his modern baler and wagon, two-thirds of the bales, the small rectangular ones, would be unloaded in the barnyard. From Virgil's point of view, there was one good thing about this. The neighbor would keep a third of the hay for his trouble. The bad thing was, somebody would have to load the other two-thirds of the bales on Frankie's ancient elevator, and somebody would have to stack it in the sweltering, wasp-infested barn loft. "Why," Virgil asked, "are barn lofts always infested with wasps?" "Because that's life," Frankie said, back floating past him on a pair of pink plastic water wings. She was unencumbered by clothing. They'd have the swimming hole to themselves until the tractor stopped running, and then the boys would take it over. For the time being, their privacy was assured by a sign at the beginning of the path through the woods that said, "Occupied," with newcomers required to call out before entering. "In the haylofts of life, there are always a few wasps." "I'm allergic to wasps," Virgil ventured. He was a tall, blonde man, his long hair now plastered like a yellow bowl over his head. "You're allergic to haying," Frankie said. "I can't even believe you bother with it," Virgil said. "You have to give a third of the hay to Carl to pay for his time and baling equipment. Whatever hay you manage to keep and sell, the feds and state take half the money. What's the point?" "I feed the hay to my cattle," she said. "We eat the cattle. There are no taxes." "You don't have any cattle," Virgil said. "The feds and state don't know that." She was another blonde, short and fairly slender. "Please don't tell me that," Virgil said. "Your goddamn tax returns must read like a mystery novel." "Should have seen my mortgage application," Frankie said. "One of those ninja deals. No income, no job." "Worked out for me, though." Honus, a big yellow dog, lay soaking wet on the bank in a spot of sunshine. He liked to swim, but he also liked to lie wet in the sun. Frankie kicked past, and Virgil ducked underwater and floated up between her legs. "You have a very attractive pussy," he said.
"I've been told that," Frankie said. "I've been thinking of entering it in the state fair."
"I could be a judge," Virgil offered. "You certainly have the necessary expertise," she said. "Speaking of state fairs, Lucas should have been killed," Virgil said, floating back a bit. "I can't believe the story's coming out of Iowa. I talked to him about it last night. He's up to his ass in bureaucrats like nothing he's ever seen. He said he's been interviewed a half dozen times by the FBI. The goddamn Purdy's almost blew up the presidential election. Would have, if he hadn't been there." "Lucas is a crazy man," Frankie said. "He chases crazy people. That's what he does, and he likes it. Anyway, that's the Iowa State Fair. I'd enter the Minnesota State Fair." "Probably do better as far as getting a ribbon," Virgil said. Frankie's knees folded over his shoulders. "Lucas said the Iowa blondes are really spectacular." Frankie said, "Wait a minute. Are you saying that I'm not spec..." She stopped, and they turned their faces toward the path. Somebody was scuffling down through the trees in violation of the occupied sign. Honus stood up and barked, 2-3 times, and Virgil and Frankie dropped their feet to the rocky bottom of the swimming hole, and Frankie called out, "Hey, who's there?" The scuffling continued for a few more seconds, then a tall, slender, wide-shouldered blonde emerged on the path and chirped, "Hi, Frank." Frankie said, "Sparkle? What are you doing here?" "I'm about to go swimming," she said. There was more scuffling behind her, and a heavyset man who probably thought he looked like Ernest Hemingway, with a Hemingway beard and Hemingway gold-rimmed glasses, stepped out of the woods. He was wearing a black T-shirt with a schematic drawing of a host and chalice, and beneath that the words, "Get real, be Catholic," plus cargo shorts and plastic flip-flops. He looked down at them and said, "Hello there." Sparkle pulled her top off. She was small-breasted and didn't wear a brassiere. Then her shorts and underpants, and jumped into the swimming hole. When she surfaced, Frankie snarled, "You really, really aren't invited." "Oh, shut up," Sparkle said. She looked at Virgil. "You must be the famous Virgil fucking Flowers." Virgil said, "Yeah, who are you?" Sparkle frowned at Frankie and said, "You've never told him?" Frankie looked like she was working up a full-blown snit. "No, why should I?" Sparkle turned back to Virgil and said, "I'm Frankie's baby sister." Virgil said to Frankie, "You have a baby sister." "Ah, for Christ's sakes," Frankie said. "Careful," Sparkle said. "You don't want to piss off Father Bill." They all looked at the heavyset man, who had removed his T-shirt, glasses, and watch, and was now stepping out of his shorts to reveal a dark brown pelt speckled with gray, which would have done credit to a cinnamon bear. "That's me," he said. He flopped into the swimming hole, came up sputtering, and said, "Gosh, nobody told me it'd be this cold." "What's the Father Bill stuff?" Frankie asked. "I'm a priest," Bill said, shaking his head like a wet dog. "Part-time, anyway." "He's a priest 9 months of the year and a bartender and libertine the other three," Sparkle said. "I work over at the Hanratty's Resort during the summer, tending bar," Bill said. "I'm a fill-in priest for the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, the other nine." "Must be nice for you," Frankie said. "It's convenient all the way around," Bill said. He had a mild, low-pitched voice that came out as a growl. "The Hanratties are always hard up for seasonal help, and the bishop gets a fill-in guy and only has to pay him for 9 months." "And you get laid," Frankie said. "A fringe benefit," Bill said. "Hey, I'm a fringe benefit?" Now Sparkle was clouding up, or faking it, pushing out her lower lip. Virgil hadn't seen the family resemblance before. Sparkle was tall and slender, Frankie was short and busty. They clouded up exactly the same way. "Okay, a major fringe benefit," Bill said. "That's better." "Ah, for Christ's sakes," Frankie said again. To Sparkle, "What are you doing here?" "Well, I thought I'd stop by and see my beloved sister, and I'm also doing the last bit of research for my dissertation." She rolled over on her back and paddled past Virgil, a not uninteresting sight. "I'm interviewing migrants at the Castro canning factory. I thought Bill and I could share your spare bedroom." Frankie scrutinized her for a couple of heartbeats, then asked, "Does old man Castro know about this?" "I haven't made what you'd call appointments, no," Sparkle said. "You're going to get your ass kicked," Frankie said. "He's a mean old son of a bitch. When it's about to happen, give me a call. I want to come and watch." "I was hoping Virgil could have a chat with the line manager over there. You know, about prisons and stuff." "You don't be dragging Virgil into this," Frankie said. "What's your problem, Frankie? Virgil's a cop. It's part of his job," Sparkle said. "He investigates after the ass-kicking, not before," Frankie said. "What's this all about?" Virgil asked. "Why is..."
Sparkle, gonna get her ass kicked.
Sparkle, backfloating between the cop and the priest, explained. She was working on her PhD dissertation about seasonal migrant labor, both the social and economic aspects, at the University of Minnesota. She'd spent 2 years among the vegetable-growing fields of southern Minnesota and was now moving upstream to the factories. When she had incorporated the factory material, she'd have her doctorate.
"Why would that get your ass kicked?" Virgil asked.
"Because old man Castro has a deal with this village down in Mexico," Sparkle said. She dropped her feet to the bottom of the pool. "They provide him couples to pick the cucumbers and work in his pickle factory. He pays the man a buck or two above the minimum wage, which makes him look like a hero, but the wife also works and doesn't get anything. So his pickers and factory workers are making a little more than half the minimum wage when it's all said and done. He would rather not have this documented."
"And you're going to write that in your dissertation?" Virgil asked.
"I am."
"Okay, I can see why you might be headed for an ass-kicking," Virgil said.
"See? Crazy shit," Frankie said to Virgil. "You should introduce her to Lucas, since Lucas likes crazy shit so much."
"Who's Lucas?" Sparkle asked.
She'd turned to her sister and stood up in waist-deep water, her back to Virgil. He noticed that she had an extremely attractive back, tapering down to a narrow waist. Backs were largely unappreciated in women, Virgil thought. But not by him.
"Another cop," Frankie said. "Actually ex-cop. He's the one who saved Michaela Bowden's life down at the Iowa State Fair last week."
"Really?" Sparkle said. "I would like to meet him."
"Ah, for Christ's sakes," Frankie said a third time.
Father Bill had ducked his head under water and had come up sputtering.
"I don't mean to be critical on such short acquaintance, but do you think you might find some way to employ vulgarity or obscenity rather than profanity, at least when I'm around?" Father Bill asked Frankie. "A nice round, 'Oh, shit,' or 'fuck you,' is much easier to accept than your taking of the Lord's name in vain."
"Ah, Jesus," Frankie said.
Virgil said quickly, "She means the Puerto Rican, not the Lord." The two women paddled up the swimming hole where the creek came in, nagging at each other. Virgil stayed at the bottom end of the pool with Bill, and Bill apologized for their abrupt entrance, saying,
"Once Sparkle starts to roll, there's not much you can do about it."
"Is her name really Sparkle?"
"No, but it's what everybody calls her," Bill said. "Somebody at Hanratty's told me that her birth name was Wanda."
They looked after the women, who'd gotten to the top of the pool where the water was shallow. They floated there, still arguing. Then Frankie stood up and dove forward. Bill's eyebrows went up as she did it, and he said,
"Oh, my. When the good Lord was passing out breasts, it looks like Frankie went through the line more than once."
Virgil said, "Yeah, well, I guess."
Bill, "You're embarrassed because I'm a priest and I'm interested in women?"
Virgil said in his quotation voice, "Kiss and re-kiss your wife. Let her love and be loved. You are fortunate in having overcome, by an honorable marriage, that celibacy in which one is a prey to devouring fires or unclean ideas. The unhappy state of a single person, male or female, reveals to me each hour of the day so many horrors that nothing sounds in my ear as bad as the name of monk or nun or priest. A married life is a paradise, even where all else is wanting."
"Really?" said Bill, sounding pleased. "Who said that?"
"Martin Luther, in a letter to a friend."
"Luther? I don't know much of Luther, other than he had horns, a forked tail, and cloven hooves instead of feet, but he said that? You're the religious sort?"
"Not so much. At least I'm not that big a believer in institutions," Virgil said. "My old man is a Lutheran minister over in Marshall. He used to soak me in that stuff, and some of it stuck."
"Good for him, good for him," Bill said. "You'll have to send me a citation for that letter so I can read it all. Martin Luther. Who would have thought?"
Is this relationship with Sparkle a long-term thing? Virgil asked.
No, no, it isn't. I spent time with her the last 2 summers, but of course, the other 9 months I'm celibate, and she doesn't put up with that.
That seems very strange to me, Virgil said.
It seems fairly strange to me, too, but I find both sides of the equation to be rewarding, Bill said. Of course, I may go to hell.
No offense, but I don't think the church gets to decide who goes to hell, Virgil said.
I'm not offended, Bill said cheerfully. In fact, I agree. Don't tell the church I said that.
The two women came paddling back, and Frankie hooked an arm around Virgil's sun-pinked neck and said,
Sparkle's going to be here for a while. You keep telling me you're going to get a queen-sized or a king-sized bed, and this would be a good time to do it, because I'm going to be sleeping over a couple times a week.
I can do that, Virgil said. That old bed is shot anyway.
Frankie said to Bill, You can go ahead and fuck Sparkle, but I don't want her squealing and screaming and all that. Keep it quiet. I got kids.
Bill said to Sparkle, Maybe we ought to find another place.
No, no, no. This is convenient, and I like hanging out with my nephews, Sparkle said.
Another thing is that Castro's goons won't find me out here.
Besides, if you tie me up and gag me, nobody will hear a thing.
They all looked at Bill, who said, Sometimes I have to struggle to keep my head from exploding.
Yeah, that's called the Sparkle effect, Frankie said.
The four of them paddled around for a while, until from the bank of the swimming hole, a phone began playing the theme from Jaws. Honus stood up and woofed at it, then lay back down, and Frankie said,
Uh-oh.
Sparkle,
what's that?
The priority number from the BCA, Virgil said. It usually means the shit has hit the fan somewhere. I gotta take it.
He'd hoped the other two would leave before he had to get out of the water, but all eyes were on him as he manfully waded out of the swimming hole, sat on the bank, and fumbled the phone out of his jeans. John Duncan calling.
John, what's up?
We need you up here. Duncan said, right away this afternoon.
What happened?
That whole thing down in Iowa, at the state fair last week, has upset the apple cart, Duncan said. You know our fair starts this week. There are going to be more politicians up here campaigning. We're worried about copycats.
Virgil groaned. Man, don't make me work the state fair.
No, no, we got that covered. Duncan said. But everybody's committed now at the fair, and we've got a new problem. A big one.
What's the problem?
Somebody stole the Amur tigers from the zoo last night, Duncan said. Apparently shot them with a tranquilizer gun and hauled them out of there. Since it's a state zoo, it's our problem.
What? Tigers?
Yeah, somebody stole the tigers, 2 Amur tigers. Pride of the zoo. Listen, man, you've got to get up here, Duncan said. There's going to be a media shitstorm starting tonight in the evening news. We got to get the tigers back, and we got to get them back right now and alive.
3. They caged the tigers separately in the bottom of the old barn in what had once been cow stalls. Since a chain-link fence had been enough to keep the tiger separated from any number of chubby, delicious-looking Minnesota zoo visitors, they'd wrapped the stalls with more chain-link. The cage doors, made from chain-link fence gates, were locked up with steel snap shackles. There'd been no electric power in the barn, the ancient wires gnawed through by rodents, so they'd bought 2 long orange cables, which they plugged in at the house and then laid across the barnyard into the lower level. Inside, the Simonian brothers had rigged up 3 work lights from Sears, hung from the rafters, and screwed in 100-watt bulbs. The work lights were plugged into a power strip at the end of one of the orange cables. The light was bright, harsh, and threw knife-edged shadows over the interior of the barn. There were no windows. Against one wall, they'd installed a makeshift table made of a 4x8 sheet of plywood sitting on aluminum sawhorses and covered with plastic sheeting. 5 waist-high meat dryers were plugged into the second orange cable. 4 plastic tubs would hold discarded guts and unneeded tiger organs. A hose, also strung over from the house, would wash everything down. Though the barn had not housed cattle for decades, there was still an earthy odor about it, not entirely unpleasant, which took Hamlet Simonian back to happier days on his grandmother's farm in Armenia. Happier at a safe distance, anyway. They'd wheeled the inert tigers into the barn and into the 2 separate cages on the dollies, then rolled them off the dollies onto the floor. The male tiger was tough to move, even though they only had to move him a foot or so off the dolly. His formidable muscles were slack as bedsheets and simply hard to get hold of, and the cage was small enough that they couldn't work standing up. When they finally got it done, they locked the cages, locked the outer door, and went and hid. Neither tiger was yet stirring. They'd given until the next day before they returned to the farm in case somebody had been watching and got curious about all the activity in the middle of the night. They met again at the farm the next morning to start work. "Shoot the fucking tiger, Ham," said Winston Peck the 6th. Peck popped a Xanax. "Do it." Peck was a tall, round-shouldered man, brown hair now touched with gray. He had a tight brown Teddy Roosevelt mustache and wore gold-rimmed glasses with round lenses. He looked like a college athlete going to seed in middle age. He was 30 pounds too heavy. "I don't know, man," Hamlet Simonian said. He was bulb-nosed, with dark hair, what was left of it, and sweating hard. He had a Remington 308 in one hand. The night before, they'd used a tranquilizer gun shooting darts to take the cats out of the zoo. "Now it seems kind of terrible, a terrible thing to do."
"You knew what was going to happen," Peck said. "You knew the plan."
"I didn't know I was going to be the shooter. I thought, hey..." The 2 tigers looked through the bars of their separate cages with a kind of quiet rapaciousness. They were beautiful animals, gold and white, with ripples of black and orange eyes. They were hungry, since it hadn't seemed to Peck that there was any point in feeding them. If the snap shackles on the doors were suddenly undone, Simonian had no doubt what would happen. They'd get eaten. Forget about the gun, forget about running. Those tigers would eat his South Caucasian ass like a hungry trucker choking down a ham sandwich. A ham Simonian sandwich. "Ham, shoot the fucking tiger."
"Why don't you do it, man? I don't think I got the guts," Simonian said.
"Maybe we ought to wait for Hake. He'd do it." Hake was Hamlet's older brother by 10 months, and he was much larger, stronger, and meaner than Hamlet.
"Because I don't know how to do it," Peck said. He was getting seriously impatient. Killing the tiger wasn't the only thing he had to do this day. He was a busy man. "I've never shot a gun in my life, and we need to get started now."
That wasn't strictly true. He'd shot rifles on several occasions, and a shotgun in the company of his father. But he wasn't sure of his skills, and mostly didn't want to be the one to shoot the tiger.
"Ah, shit."
Simonian edged up to the male tiger's cage. He was by far the larger of the 2, though that wouldn't matter much if either one of them got out. The smaller female, Katya, weighed nearly 400 pounds, and to the nervous Simonian, it seemed like 20 pounds of that was teeth and claws. Getting taken down by Katya would be like getting attacked by a 400-pound chainsaw. And forget about it with Artur, the muscular male. He was 640 pounds of furry hunger. He could take your head off with one swipe of his well-armed paw and then squish it like a grape between his 3-inch canine teeth.
"Shoot the fucking tiger," Peck said.
Simonian lifted the gun and looked down the iron sights at Artur, who stared calmly back at him, unafraid, even though something about his eyes suggested that he knew what was coming. Drips of sweat rolled into Hamlet's eyes, and he took the gun down and wiped the sweat away with his shirt sleeve, then brought the gun back up and aimed right between the tiger's eyes, 5 feet away, and yanked the trigger.
The gun went off, and to Simonian's surprise, the tiger dropped to the floor, stone cold dead. Katya, the female, screamed and launched herself at the cage's chain-link fence, which ballooned out toward Simonian, who scrambled away from the maddened cat. The muzzle blast inside the barn basement had been ferocious, and Simonian could hear his ears ringing. It was a moment before he became aware that Peck was running around the barn shouting, "Whoa! Whoa! Whoa!"
"What? What?"
"You shot me, you asshole!" Peck said. He was holding his hand flat on his head, and when he took it away, there was a splash of blood in his palm. His baseball cap, which had been given to him by a crew member of the movie The Revenant, lay on the floor. Peck told people it was a gift from Leonardo DiCaprio himself, though he was lying about that.
"Let me look, let me look," Simonian said.
Behind him, Katya threw herself at the cage again, a rattling impact that bent the chain-link fence.
"Hurts, hurts, hurts," Peck cried, still wandering in circles.
Simonian nervously watched the agitated cat as he and Peck moved to one of the work lights, and Peck tilted his head down. Through his thinning hair, Simonian could see a knife-like cut that was bleeding, but seemed superficial.
"It's not bad," he reported. "Must have been a ricochet. A little scrap of metal or something. You could press some toilet paper against it and the bleeding would stop."
"You sure?"
"Yeah, it looks like a paper cut," Simonian said. "It's nothing.
Hurts like a motherfucker. I'm lucky I'm not dead," Peck said. "I'm going to go find some toilet paper. You drag the cat out of there."
"Drag the cat? Man, he weighs 600 pounds or something.
Use the dolly. I didn't expect you to throw it over your shoulder, dumbass," Peck said. "I'm going to go get some toilet paper. I'm bleeding like a sieve here."
"Okay.
Speaking of dumbasses, where's your dumbass brother? He was supposed to be here an hour ago."
"He had to get a knife, a special knife for removing the skin," Simonian said.
He dropped the rifle, which hit the floor with a noisy clank, and Peck flinched away. Simonian picked it up and said,
"No bullet in the thing."
He tapped the bolt.
"No bullet in the thing," Peck repeated, shaking his head. "You're a real fucking gunman, you know that, dumbass?"
"If I'm such a dumbass, how come I shoot the tiger and it drops dead? One shot?" Simonian asked.
"Blind luck," Peck said. He added, "I gotta get some toilet paper."
He picked his hat up off the floor, looked at it, said, "You shot a hole in it. This is my best hat and it's ruined. I'm amazed that you didn't shoot me between the eyes." He tramped off toward the door and out onto the slice of green lawn that Simonian could see from where he was standing. A second later, Peck stepped back and said, "I'm sorry about that dumbass thing. I'm a little tense, you know." "That was a good shot. I'm proud of you, Hamlet. I mean, except for the part where the shrapnel hit me. You sure the tiger's dead?"
"He better be," Simonian said, "or Hake gonna get one big surprise when he tries to skin that bad boy."
"Yeah," said Peck. "I'm gonna get toilet paper." He disappeared into the sunshine, headed for his truck, where he kept a first aid kit. He wasn't really sorry about calling Simonian a dumbass, because Simonian was a dumbass. He had to pretend, though, because he still needed the brothers. For a while, anyway. That was simple good management. Back in the barn, Hamlet Simonian turned back to the cages, where Katya was making desperate purring sounds at her mate, as though trying to rouse him from a deep sleep. She knew he was dead, Simonian thought. He could see it in her eyes when she turned to look at him. Another thought occurred to him. He should shoot her now. He shouldn't wait, despite Peck. If he didn't shoot her now, something bad would happen, like really bad. He thought about it, then started rolling a dolly over to the dead tiger's cage. He didn't have the guts to shoot another tiger, at least not on the same day that he'd shot the first one. But not shooting the girl, he thought, was a mistake. They were going to make it anyway. 4. Virgil made a hurried trip from Frankie's farm back to Mankato, where he lived. He left Honus at the farm, and as he left, the dog stood in the driveway and barked once. The bark was a familiar one, and translated as,
asshole!
Honus stayed with Frankie and her kids when Virgil was out of town, but preferred to hang with Virgil because Virgil had the best arm and also took him for long, lazy walks. And because out in the woods, Virgil would occasionally pee on a tree, like a good dog. Honus was named after Honus Wagner, the shortstop. No grounder ever got past him, although he was occasionally fooled by pop flies. Since he would be working in the metro area, where BCA officials might see him, Virgil traded his Creaky Boards band t-shirt for a plain black golf shirt, added a sport coat, kept his jeans, and put a quick polish on his cowboy boots. Heeding advice from his departed boss, Lucas Davenport, he got his pistol out of the gun safe in the truck and wore it, though it was uncomfortably heavy. "Bureaucrats are afraid of guns," Davenport had told him. "If you wear one, it gives you an edge." The zoo was on the south side of the metro area, 75 miles away. He made the trip in a comfortable hour. John Duncan, his new boss, said it was an emergency, so he went up with flashers and an occasional siren to move the lagging left-lane drivers, because it was not only faster, but also because it was fun. Frankie called as he was headed north. "I got Sparkle and Bill settled in. Bill worries me. He's too nice and normal for my household. He's even made friends with Sam." "What'd he do, show him how to make dynamite?" Sam was Frankie's youngest, a fourth grader, the kind of kid who'd eventually jump off the barn roof with a homemade parachute. "Almost as bad. He showed him how to drive Sparkle's Mini. Sam was driving it around the yard when Sparkle and I went to see what was going on. Anyway, they're gonna stay. I might spend more than a few nights at your place. Sparkle's already gotten on my nerves." "How's that?" "Well, for one thing, you spent an unusual amount of time checking her out in the swimming hole," Frankie said. "Hey, a good-looking naked woman jumps in a swimming hole with you, you're gonna check her out," Virgil said. "That's normal. Been going on for a million years, and there's nothing in it. That's good, because you mess around with Sparkle, you could get yourself stabbed," Frankie said. "She carries a knife?" "No, but I do." The Minnesota Zoo was in the town of Apple Valley, a bedroom suburb south of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Virgil left his 4Runner in a no-parking spot, flipped his Bureau of Criminal Apprehension official business card onto the dashboard, and walked down to the main entrance. A pack of kids was playing on a couple of full-sized bronze buffaloes at the end of the parking lot, and Virgil nodded at a pretty mother. And down the sidewalk, more kids were playing on some bronze wolves, and Virgil gave another young mother a nod. Duncan was waiting for him by the admission counter. "Man, am I happy to see you," he said. Duncan was on the tall side, with neat brown hair, thickly lashed brown eyes, and big teeth. TV cameras liked him, and he liked them back. "You even got dressed up. You even got your gun. All right." "They're waiting inside." "Who's they?" Virgil asked. "Virginia Landseer, the zoo director. She's the one with gray hair. Robert McCall, the chairman of the board. He's got the black-rimmed arty glasses. And a couple of other rich people. A maintenance guy and an Apple Valley investigator," Duncan said. Duncan had been a fair street cop, but he was happier as a manager. "They were talking about wolf fetuses when I came out to look for you." "Will I get any help on this?" Virgil asked. "I gotta tell you, man, after what happened in Iowa, probably not," Duncan said, as he led Virgil through an unmarked door to the director's office. "We've about moved everybody in the building over to the fairgrounds. Losing the Tigers is bad. Losing a presidential candidate would really bum everybody out, especially if it was one of the liberal ones." "Great," Virgil said. 2 hours earlier, he'd been floating in a swimming hole with two good-looking naked blondes and a guy who resembled a bear. Now he was walking through what looked and felt like a bunker. "One administrative question. Why am I doing this if Apple Valley already has a guy on it? It's their jurisdiction." "Because we think it's unlikely that this was done by Apple Valley residents, or that the Tigers are still around here.
It's not really an Apple Valley crime the way we see it, Duncan said. The other thing is, there's a druggie going around town kicking in back doors. He's hitting 2 or 3 houses a day, and he seems to know what he's doing because the cops don't have a clue who it is. People are getting pissed, and the Apple Valley cops are getting a lot of pressure to stop him. They don't have time for the tigers, if somebody else can do it. And it really is our problem.
Okay, Virgil said, and, listen, John, I'll do this for you. But after that thing with the dogs, I don't want to become the BCA's designated dog catcher.
These are cats. You know what I mean, Virgil said.
I do. And don't worry about it. We're not headed in that direction, Duncan said. This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You get these cats back, and I'll see that you never do another animal job in your life.
They were walking down a concrete hallway to the director's office, and Virgil asked,
Anybody got any ideas about how this happened?
Lots of ideas, not so much evidence, Duncan said. They'll tell you the details. Their head maintenance guy is in there. He seems to know the most. They found a cleanup guy, a janitor, I guess, though he works outside shoveling shit or something, who heard what might have been a couple shots from a tranquilizer gun in the middle of the night.
They got to the director's office and Duncan held the door. Virgil stepped inside to find a half dozen people crowded into an inner office who stopped talking to look at him. Duncan bumped past him and said,
Everybody, this is Virgil Flowers, one of our very best investigators. He'll want to hear what you all have to say, and then, well, I'll let Virgil take it from there.
A gray-haired woman, who otherwise looked like she might be in her middle 30s, and who had to be Landseer, the director, said, Welcome. As she stood to shake hands. She introduced McCall, the board chairman, with the arty black-rimmed glasses, and 2 other board members, Nancy Farrelly and Gina Larimore, and Dan Best, the head of maintenance, and Andy White, the Apple Valley cop. Larimore said to Virgil, You're the man who broke that illegal dog-napping ring down on the Mississippi.
Yes, ma'am, Virgil said.
That's a worthwhile credential, she said. We are desperate to get our tigers back. How long do you think it'll take?
I don't know, Virgil said. Anything between this afternoon and never, depending on what the thieves have done with them. If they put them in the back of a truck and are halfway to California, it could be tough.
Don't say never. Don't say that, McCall said. He was a red-faced man in a suit and dress shirt with a 2-tone blue and white collar. We've got to find them, and we have to be quick about it. I know that puts pressure on you, but we can only think of 3 reasons for somebody to steal them.
Which are? Duncan had pulled a plastic chair into the office from the outer room, and Virgil took it and sat down.
1, it's an anti-zoo nut, McCall said.
Those people are mostly talk, as unpleasant as they can be.
2, it could be somebody who deals in live exotic animals. There's a lot of that down in Texas, and owning tigers is more common than you'd think. There might be 5,000 privately owned tigers in the U.S. And 3, and this is the worst possibility, it's somebody who wants to sell the tiger parts to be used in traditional Asian medicine. Almost all the parts are used in one form or another. That would involve killing the tigers, of course.
Don't say that, Bob, said Farrelly.
Tears rolled down her face, and she wiped them away with a tissue.
I can't stand to even hear that.
We all know it's true enough, McCall said, scanning the other faces in the room. To Virgil, here's the thing. Of the 3 possibilities, I'm afraid the medicine thing is the most likely. If it was exotic animal dealers, well, you can get tigers relatively cheap. You don't need to steal them and take a chance on going to prison. Anti-zoo people probably wouldn't go after tigers. They'd take something easier.
Not if they wanted to make a spectacular point, Larimore said.
If that's what it is, they'll have to go public, and we'll get them back. And we haven't heard a word from those people, McCall said. The tigers' real value, they're Amur tigers, and they're rare in the wild. would be as ingredients in traditional Chinese medicine. They're DNA certified as real Amurs, of course, since they were here in the zoo. If you wanted that kind of medicine, they'd be all you could ask for. As medicine, they'd be worth a lot.
How much? Virgil asked.
McCall said, all I know about that market is what I looked up on the internet, and I have no idea of the accuracy of the estimate. The Amurs are highly valued in China, and they're on the endangered species list. Depends on your connections with the market, but two healthy certified Amurs could bring, as parts, maybe $250,000? That's what I get from the internet, anyway.
There's a motive, Duncan said.
If that's who's got them, then they're already dead, or will be soon, McCall said, turning his eyes to Virgil. That's why you've got to find them fast.
Has the media been here? Virgil asked.
Oh, yes, Landseer said. We did a press conference at 1 o'clock, but I have several requests for further interviews at 4 this afternoon. We'll have to do it. They're really the taxpayers' animals.
Virgil looked over at Duncan and asked,
John, do you know Dave the Rotten Bastard up in the Attorney General's office?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you call him and find out the highest possible level of criminal offense he could charge with this case, and the longest possible prison term? Virgil asked. Then when Ms. Landseer has her press conference, maybe you could step up and talk about all that.
What good will that do? Asked Best, the maintenance man.
I'm hoping that it'll scare the heck out of the thieves, Virgil said. Dave is a smart guy, and he'll know exactly what we want. He'll come up with a list of crimes you won't believe, something like 30 years in prison if they're convicted. With any luck, the perpetrators will give the cats up or tell us where they're at. If they're planning to kill them, maybe they won't do that.
That's good. That's very good, McCall said. First good thing I've heard. Can we get that set up in time for the press conference?
I can set it up in 10 minutes, Duncan said. He would not be unhappy to be on TV.
Best asked Virgil,
why's the guy called the Rotten Bastard?
Virgil said, when he was a prosecutor in St. Paul, he had a 10-year-old crack runner shoot and kill a 12-year-old. Dave tried to get the 10-year-old certified for trial as an adult.
Gosh, that is a rotten bastard, Farrelly said.
Duncan asked Virgil, what else do you need right now?
Virgil looked around at the group and said, I need to know what you think. You're all familiar with this place. How'd they do this? Did they need special equipment to get in? Did they need night vision gear, for instance? Did they have to saw through any steel bars that would require special equipment? Somebody mentioned a tranquilizer gun. Where would they get one of those? Do you have any video cameras?
Best, the maintenance supervisor, said, I can answer most of that.
Good, Virgil said. Let's talk.
A maintenance worker had noticed that the tigers were missing at 8:30 that morning, shortly before the zoo was due to open. The tigers hadn't been missed before that because they'd spent the night in their outdoor containment, an area roomy enough that not all of it could be seen from any one place, rather than the usual indoor night containment.
I guess everybody who might have seen them thought they were on the other side, said Best.
The maintenance worker had been dragging a broken food pallet around to a dumpster when he noticed what seemed to be a fault in a chain-link fence. When he looked closer, he found that it had been cut through. He investigated further and found another hole cut in a fence around the tiger compound. The man told one of the animal handlers who checked the tiger compound and found that the animals were missing.
He was like, shit, where are the tigers?
He was totally freaked out. He was worried somebody had freed them, and they were running around loose.
They called the Apple Valley cops, who'd called the local schools and had them locked down, and then had run a sweep through the area looking for the cats. When they didn't find them, they called the BCA.
White, the Apple Valley cop said, when we decided they'd been stolen, been taken, we figured the thieves had to come in from the parking lot. There's a surveillance camera out there, but nobody monitoring it overnight. The camera spools to a hard drive with a month-long cache.
we took a look at last night's recording, and whoever did it knew where the camera was. It's mounted on a light pole, and they climbed the pole from behind the camera and sprayed some paint onto the lens. Virgil. You're saying at least one of them came in on foot, messed up the camera, and then they brought in a truck or a van? White and Best glanced at each other, and Best shrugged, and White said, No, that's not what we think, not quite. I don't know why they messed with that camera, but they did. At 1:08 in the morning. The thing is, there's another camera that looks out in the entrance. There's only one entrance, and they might not have known about it because it's not easy to see. Anyway, they didn't mess with that one, and no cars or trucks came or went between 11 o'clock and the morning shift change. You're saying the truck was probably already here. Maybe came in during a shift change, and then they waited until there was another change? Virgil asked. Don't know, White said, shaking his head. That seems really not right. I really don't know what they did. Anyway, they were here, and they probably walked up a service road where they came to a barred gate. They needed a key to get through that. When we looked this morning, we found that it was open, unlocked, but not damaged. Then there's an insider somewhere along the way, Virgil said. If the insider arrived in his truck, took out the camera. They figured that out even before I got here, White said. There aren't many people on the overnight, and we've been checking them all day. They're all accounted for. Most of them walked out to their cars with friends, and you're not going to get two tigers in a Hyundai. We could eliminate most of the cars by looking at them. There were four trucks, and we've been all over those, and I gotta say, they don't look connected with this. White explained that three of the four trucks had open beds, and that the video camera at the front gate was mounted high enough that they could see the truck beds were empty. The fourth truck had a camper. I've talked to that guy, and I don't think he had anything to do with it. He's an electrician who was here to work on some lights. He showed me his truck. The back's all built out with tools and parts and supplies. You might be able to get a tiger or two in there if you stack them up, but it wouldn't be a sure thing, and it wouldn't be an easy job. Anyway, he doesn't seem right. Besides, he was working all night where people could see him. Everybody nodded, and Landseer said, We hate to think that there was an insider involved, but if somebody unlocked that gate, there doesn't seem to be any other possibility. Well, there are, but an insider seems like the best bet, Virgil said. Are the keys controlled, or are they all over the place? A limited number of people have them, but there have been copies along the way when keys got lost, so we don't know exactly how many there really are, Landseer said. We know there are 8 authorized keys, 6 people plus 2 spares. Unfortunately, the spares are kept where any number of people could access them. Both of them are still on their hook, I checked. If somebody took one of the spares and copied it and returned the original, we wouldn't know it. Huh, Virgil said. And back to Best. John told me that one of your guys heard something that might have been a tranquilizer gun last night. Is that right? Yeah, Joel Charvin. He's a cleanup guy working the overnight. He was on the other side of the zoo, and a tranquilizer gun isn't loud. They're gas-operated, so they don't make much noise at all. Kind of a boo sound. Nothing like a shot. Like a pellet gun, Virgil suggested. Bess nodded. Like that. Loud as a hand clap, maybe, but not as sharp as a shot from a regular gun. Does this Charvin guy know what a tranquilizer gun sounds like? Virgil asked. Yeah, he does. We use them from time to time, Bess said. He doesn't do it, but he knows what they sound like. He was on the far side of the zoo when he heard the noises, the shots. He didn't identify them at the time as coming from a tranquilizer gun. He didn't see anything, so he went on cleaning up. Virgil said, Okay, so a couple guys cut their way through fences, shoot the tigers with a tranquilizer gun. Would they need night vision gear for that, or is there enough ambient light?